Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 10th of September. Marvin Kalb is joining us this hour. The hour is too short for all we have to talk about with this man. He's written a wonderful book which outlines the history of really the Korean War and the Vietnam War, worthy of hour-long conversations themselves, and so well written. But of course, we have this other news that's developing hour by hour. And because of his background, we'll be sure to start our show by talking about this international diplomatic momentum to keep that military strike from taking place on Syria, the Russian proposal aimed at securing and destroying the weapons, but today's news that they will not accept the threat of force, and that seems to be an important part of all of this discussion. So what would the president say tonight, and what about the Russians' proposal? We, of course, have to talk to Marvin Kalb about that. For those of you who didn't have a chance, you're too young to know about his television career, what a career he's had. His book is The Road to War, Presidential Commitments Honored and Betrayed. He joined CBS News in 1957, the last correspondent hired by Edward R. Murrow, and thus began a distinguished 30-year broadcast career working for CBS and NBC. He was chief diplomatic correspondent, Moscow bureau chief, moderator of Meet the Press. He's the Edward R. Murrow Professor Emeritus at Harvard Kennedy School of Government, a contributing news analyst for NPR and Fox News Channel. He's at the Brookings Institute joining us today. And he was founding director of the Joan Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Has authored 10 nonfiction books and 2 best-selling novels. Marvin Kalb, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Kathleen, hi there. It's a pleasure to be with you. I love that introduction.
Thank you. Well, you know, it seems like an hour seems like a long period of time, but I was thinking today, how much are we going to do on Syria? We got to start there, but we have to have you back because the chapters on Vietnam were superb, as was the one on Korea, just superb. But let's start with Syria and the Russian proposal, because you evidently were getting your PhD in Russian history before you went to CBS, so you know this country pretty well. Where did this come from?
You know, it's very hard to say that, Kathleen, because we are hearing that the origin of this proposal either came from the president in a conversation with Putin a month or so ago, then repeated when the president was in St. Petersburg last week. We've also heard that it was the result of an accident, in a way, a diplomatic accident, when the Secretary of State, John Kerry, said that wouldn't it be a terrific idea if we could get rid of all of the chemical weapons that Syria had. But then he quickly added, but that's not likely to happen. Mm-hmm. Then later in the day yesterday, the idea that there might be a diplomatic way out of the current impasse that the president finds himself in, well, a lot of people latched onto this Russian, Syrian, Kerry, Obama idea. Nobody quite knows exactly where it started, but it is now being owned by everybody because people think maybe this is a way of avoiding an American military strike.
Well, it's kind of weird because now you've got the United States saying that, well, it's because of the threat of a military strike that the Syrians agreed to this. And you've got the Russians saying, hey, you can't talk anymore about a military strike or the deal's off.
Right. And it is an extremely complicated but at the same time fascinating bit of diplomatic maneuvering taking place really before our eyes. There's an awful lot of it obviously taking place quietly and not things that we can see or hear. But at the moment, we are seeing and hearing enough to give us a sense that the president will do just about anything not to launch a military strike against Syria. He is the most reluctant warrior we've had in the White House in a long, long time.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And yet he has put himself into a position by saying that there can be a red line that nobody can cross in the use of chemical weapons. Mm-hmm. He said that a year ago. Having said it, he now finds himself in a position of having to live up to what it is that he said, or else he loses personal credibility and the nation loses national credibility. So there's a great deal riding on the outcome of this adventure.
So he was going to ask Congress for authorization for a military strike. What's he going to ask for now?
I think that's a marvelous question. I have a feeling he's going to stay with the request for the authorization to strike Syria. He said yesterday in a series of television interviews to just about every network that this possibility that we could avoid a strike on Syria by the Syrians giving up all of their chemical weapons, putting it all under international control, and then the Russian idea that after that they would all be destroyed. Well, that sounded good enough to put pressure on the president to think about not proceeding with his original request for authorization to strike Syria. But if he backs out now without an absolutely clear-cut agreement with the Russians, with the rest of the world, and even with the Syrians, he's going to look awfully bad.
Right.
And no politician, and he is first and foremost, every president is, a politician who wants to look good and look like a man who has laid down the law, and by God, people are going to obey it.
Mm-hmm. We'll ask our listeners what they hope the president will focus on tonight in his address, which we will carry starting at 8 o'clock this evening. Marvin Kalb is our guest. His book focuses on many other presidents since Harry Truman and looks at commitments honored and betrayed, and they're getting us into war without congressional approval. And let's go to Harry Truman first, because we got the UN. We're dealing with the UN and this Syrian crisis, sort of.
Yes.
We are, and then we're not. But you write about Harry Truman being the first president to take us into war without any form of congressional authorization, sort of a police state. He's doing this was a police state thing, and he was using the United Nations as a way to justify action in North Korea.
Well, it's really fascinating. When I first started doing research for this book, and by the way, that was about 40 years ago, I hate to admit it. I've done a lot of other books in the meantime, but this issue of presidential war-making powers has been in my mind for an awfully long time. And ever since I was covering the Vietnam War many years ago, the question came up over and over again. On what basis does a president have the right to send, as was the case in Vietnam, 548,000 American troops mm-hmm. to South Vietnam to fight the communists? On what basis? Mm-hmm. What gives him that kind of power? And it turns out that presidents, because they are commanders-in-chief, assumed for themselves that kind of war-making power. Theoretically, every president is supposed to go to Congress, which has a constitutional responsibility to, quote, declare war, and second, to provide the money for the carrying out of a war. So Congress has always had enormous responsibility on the issue of the country going to war. So why didn't the two of them work together, as had been the case up until World War II? And my own gut feeling, and it started with Harry Truman, was that when World War II ended, and we were sudden, and it ended, by the way, with the use of two nuclear bombs dropped by the United States on Japan. That mm-hmm. was the end of the war. That was such a horrendous action that Harry Truman told a number of his friends at that time, look, anytime we ever get to a point where we, the U.S., has to use weapons of mass destruction on anybody, please, that cannot happen unless the President of the United States gives his personal approval. And with that came an assumption of power that was not really written down anywhere. It just sort of happened. And when the communists attacked South Korea in June of 1950, Harry Truman, who had promised Congress he would never send troops abroad to fight unless he went to Congress for permission first. Harry Truman didn't go to Congress. He went to the UN Security Council, which gave him permission to launch what he called a police action, not a war. And since that time, one president after another has taken the United States into war without checking with Congress. When he did check with Congress, which happened every now and then, Congress would, in effect, give the president a pat on the back and say, you know best, you lead the country into this war, and you get us out. Congress had a right to declare war, but never did, not since December 1941.
And the possible decisions that a president himself could make, you also write about, I guess I wasn't aware of this, Marvin, that UPI was reporting, and I'm wondering if this was true, that Truman said that the United States had under consideration use of the atomic bomb again in connection with the war in Korea, which is unbelievable.
That did, yes, it was unreal, and it even came up with President Eisenhower at the beginning of the war in Vietnam. In other words, there have always been a number of people which today we would describe as very, very conservative, very right-wing, also extremely patriotic and believing that the United States can do no wrong anywhere in the world. And that meant that these people would threaten to use atomic power in order to get their way in an international crisis. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, every one of the presidents since Harry Truman, when faced with that prospect, the use of nuclear weapons, all of them, starting with Eisenhower, said, no, we are not using those weapons unless our national security is on the line. Then, of course, we would use and have the right to use all weapons to protect ourselves. Mm. But this power of the presidency to make war, to essentially do it on his own, was the issue that so fascinated me, that drove me really over many years to write The Road to War, because I felt it was almost incumbent upon me to try to explain this issue. Because right now, Kathleen, right now in Washington, I hear very serious people, both on Capitol Hill, at the White House, at the State Department, people who are arguing, what exactly is the war-making power of a president? Mm-hmm. What is it that he can do? Do we turn to the Constitution for an answer? Do we turn to tradition, whatever that means, for an answer? And the answer to that is we don't know. Mm-hmm. Each president kind of works it out on his own. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, anyway, prompting The Road to War, that, to me, was totally inadequate. Mm-hmm. When you go to war, that's a big thing. People are going to die. You cannot send somebody to war simply because of a whim, simply because you think it's the best thing to do. It seems to me that the people of this country, through their elected representatives, have to have a voice in that decision. Mm-hmm.
Another theme that runs through the book, Marvin, is how ill-informed we are, the presidents are, in making some of these decisions, so that mm-hmm. Truman had no idea about the strength of the Chinese in North Korea. I mean, how could you miss something like that? Or that Kennedy is sending advisor after advisor to find out what the heck's going on in South Vietnam, or Eisenhower is supporting somebody he doesn't think is very good, you know, but, I mean, it turns out he's terrible, and then we support somebody else who's terrible, and we're trying to get an assessment on the ground of what's actually happening, and the advisors get it wrong.
Kathleen, you hit it right on the head. It is very easy for an American citizen to have absolute faith. Maybe that's too strong a word these days, but to have a sense of confidence that their leaders know what it is that they're doing, are well-read, well-informed. But unfortunately, if we go into the history of the American involvement in Vietnam, which was a terribly long war, we lost 58,000 mm-hmm. people there. And we lost the war. When it was all over, we lost. It was the first war the U.S. ever lost. When you think about that, you have to think back and say to yourself, surely, one, there was a very good reason for this. Two, our leaders understood the enemy, understood his strength, understood perhaps his weaknesses that could be exploited. In any case, that we were in the hands of highly informed people. Unfortunately, that is simply not the case.
Right.
Harry Truman, as you mentioned a moment ago, Harry Truman was a man of extraordinary goodwill and determination to do the right thing. But when Harry Truman sent forces, American forces, into Korea, he did it for the very large reason, perfectly valid, to stop the communists from expanding their empire. But he didn't know what the Chinese communists were up to. He really didn't know. And because the Chinese communists had just become communist after their revolution of 1949, the year before, he was not yet ready to study that subject. And so he took action without knowing quite what was going to happen or whether it was the right thing to do. Eisenhower, a superb general, he did not want to allow American forces to get involved on the ground fighting what he said was the responsibility of Asiatic, quote-unquote, boys. Well, Eisenhower, a terrific soldier, was not that great a historian. John Kennedy, very smart, well-read. John Kennedy had people around him with respect to our early deep involvement in Vietnam who hadn't a clue as to what was going on in Vietnam. They didn't understand the religion. They didn't understand the politics. They didn't understand the mafia-like gangs that took place politically and economically in Saigon. We went in because of the large belief that we had to stop the spread of communism without understanding what we were getting involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And forgive me, Kathleen, if I jump ahead now because I can't resist.
It's all right.
We may be getting involved in Syria in a big way. We may be. I don't know. Do we really know the people in Syria? Do we really know the opposition?
I don't think so.
Do we really know the strength of Assad? Could he be on the edge of tipping over, and that's why he's maybe willing to let the international community take charge of his chemical weapons? We know so little. We want to know more. We should know more, but we don't.
Marvin Kalb is our guest this hour. His book, well worth a read. It covers so much important U.S. history, The Road to War, Presidential Commitments Honored and Betrayed. We welcome your phone calls. You can talk about Syria as well as we try to figure out what in the world's going on, what the president is likely to say tonight, what he should say, what his dealings are with Congress, what his relationship is with Russia, why Russia came forth with this proposal, what their relationship is with Syria, how what's happening today is informed by what happened in other wars and in other presidential administrations. So that's what's on the table. It's a lot. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to go to that, that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Marvin Kalb, he'll be familiar to many of you. He was a reporter, a fine reporter for CBS and NBC for some 30 years. He's Edward R. Murrow Professor Emeritus at Harvard and guest scholar in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, which is where he is today joining us. And his book is The Road to War, Presidential Commitments Honored and Betrayed. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Marvin Kalb is with us this hour. His book is The Road to War, Presidential Commitments Honored and Betrayed. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And Eugene in Viola is our first caller. Marvin, hi, Eugene.
Hello, good afternoon, Kathleen, to your guest, Marvin. I'm old enough to remember the Bay of Pigs. And what I'm wondering is, if we had maintained air cover and those supply ships would have stayed offshore, could that have been won? Or was Kennedy so badly misled by his advisor that that was a no-win situation from the beginning? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Eugene.
Well, Eugene, that's a very interesting question, and it really has a relevance to what's going on today. Presidents are, in a way, prisoners of their advisors. They do have independent judgment. We're lucky when they are really smart. They are not all that smart, but we're lucky when they are really smart, when they're well-read. President Kennedy was one of those, but he was, in a sense, the victim of the moment and of the advice of his closest colleagues. Kennedy did not want to get involved. That's that great expression, which we're hearing a lot of right now with Syria. And there's a feeling in the United States, and it goes back many decades, and you and I are old enough, Eugene, to remember these things. When we don't want to get involved is a form of isolationism, but not a malicious form. It's just an innocent belief that we don't want to get involved in other people's problems. The Bay of Pigs was one of those moments when the president got terrible, terrible advice. He was very leery to get involved in Cuba. He didn't want to. He figured that he might be able to make a political deal with Castro. But he wasn't able to do that, and he went along with the judgment of the State Department, the judgment of the Pentagon, and they all said to him that we have trained these Cubans to do a first-class job. Kennedy, who was in office then only for 2 months, gave the green light, and it was a catastrophe. This is the question that is before every president when he has to send troops to fight. That's why the issue of the war-making powers of a president is so central in our lives and has been for a long time and certainly is right now. We are left with a feeling, an unfortunate feeling, that there isn't a system in place that places the president in the right position, the Congress in the right position, the courts in the right position, public opinion in the right position, and you all move forward together as a nation to commit force to a war. We don't have that. So we are left with a president determining essentially on his own what is in the best interest of the country.
Well, let me ask you a two-part question here. Do you believe that Presidents Johnson, Nixon, Eisenhower, and maybe even Truman believed in their heart of hearts that we really faced a threat from a communist world and that it was a showdown and they simply could not, the domino theory, we simply could not let too many countries fall into communist hands because our way of life would be threatened?
Kathleen, I believe that every single one of these presidents believed that to his very core, believed that communism was a existential threat to the American way of life. And I have to tell you, you were very kind in introducing me to talk about that time early in my journalistic career when I functioned as the Moscow bureau chief for CBS News and was there for 5 years during the period from roughly 1956 to 63. And I can tell you that when you go there and you live in a society dominated by communist philosophy, ideology, way of life, thinking, it is and it was a dreadful, dreadful, inhumane system. However, the Russian people would absorb some of it, but not all of it. And American presidents, because they didn't live there, they absorbed almost all of the really dreadful activity associated with communism in power. So the answer to your question is absolutely. I feel to the bottom of my heart that every single president did this with the best intention in the world to protect the United States against what he assumed was a deadly existential threat to the American way of life. Yes.
And going ahead to now, do you believe that President Obama and President Bush, for that matter, believe in their heart of hearts that the use of chemical weapons, the existence of al-Qaeda and the actions of al-Qaeda and what's going on in Syria, let's make it focus on Syria right now, is indeed a threat, chemical weapons, their regime, al-Qaeda forces, although nobody talks very much about those in opposition to Assad. But the use of those weapons somehow create a real national security threat to us.
You know, Kathleen, it's a matter of how you define these things. And the president chooses to define it in rather stark terms. I personally tend to agree with him. I think that the use of chemical weapons is a horrendous form of warfare. And when it is used not against soldiers but against innocent civilians, it raises the crime to an international level, and it ought to be addressed. The question is, in addressing it, what is the best way? Is the best way to take our strength and apply it militarily against the Syrian regime, or can it be done diplomatically? Right now, the president is faced with that conundrum. The Russians have laid out a proposal. The Syrians are going along with it, at least rhetorically. The president is going along with it, making the point that it has to be checked out carefully. As President Reagan said, it had to be verified. And I suspect that secretly, privately, I should say, right now, American diplomats working with our allies in Europe are trying to do just that. They're trying to figure out whether, diplomatically, we can achieve the same aim that we would if we were to apply military power. The president said several times yesterday, if there were a way of doing it diplomatically, he much prefers that route. And I think in his speech tonight, he is going to lay out, and it'll be a difficult thing for him to do, no doubt, but he's going to lay out, one, why he still feels it is necessary to have the authority militarily to strike Syria at the same time as diplomatically he is seeking a way not to use his military strength.
Ah, what a speech. This is going to be a very interesting speech.
It'll be fascinating.
Yes,
absolutely.
It will. David in Ironwood. Hi, David.
Yeah, I sort of agree with that whole thing. I think the Congress should pass a resolution saying that if Syria turns over all their weapons and verifies that, no, we won't attack. But if it doesn't, give Obama the whole to do whatever he wants. You know, matter of fact, I think it would be good if the Congress or even be more hawkish. I mean, if we could scare Syria into turning all these weapons over, and to turn them over, you probably have to have a ceasefire. And maybe during the ceasefire, we could actually get a peace thing going.
Marvin.
Excellent. Excellent thought. And a wonderful line of the logic. I love what David was saying there. It's going to be extremely difficult, though, David, extremely difficult for one very simple reason. Assad has, to use one of my children's favorite expressions, has lied through his teeth time and time and time again. So he can say that he would like an international body, the United Nations, to come in and take control of the weapons. Will he tell that body where all of the weapons are? Will he keep some of them in a secret place and tell nobody? These are questions I'm not raising to be negative, but they are realistic questions. This is not a nice man, and he is not anyone who can be believed readily. He's a liar. And that's been proven time and again. If there is a way, it's going to be a tricky way. The president is going to have to take a big chance, and the Congress will still have to give him the authority, should this diplomatic effort fail within a specific period of time. You can't go on with the diplomatic effort forever. He would have to say it has to be accomplished within a week, a month, something like that. And if it could be in that period of time, great. But if it isn't, the president then must have the authority on his own, not at that time going to Congress, to take action against Syria.
Hmm. And being an expert in Russia as you are, it's sort of, Russia's just such a mysterious state as China is to me in so many ways. Can you imagine what happened here? Did the Syrians express concern that the U.S. was going to strike them militarily? And do you think that Putin talked with Obama about this last week at the meeting? It's just hard to figure out because the tensions have been so great between our two countries.
Yes.
The avenues that made this all possible.
Yes. Well, the president did say on the record yesterday that he has talked to Putin about this idea.
Mm-hmm.
So the two top men have discussed it. So that's kind of a good thing. And then their immediate underlings, the Secretary of State and the U.S. side, the Foreign Minister on the Russian side, have pursued it quietly. Then it breaks into the open yesterday, and I think probably prematurely breaks into the open. And then it becomes very much part of what the president's strategy has to be and what Putin's strategy has to be. And because the Syrians are so indebted to the Russians, so completely indebted to them for weapons and political and diplomatic support, if the Russians want to move in this direction, if they're serious about it, then I believe that Assad will go along for the ride. He said to Charlie Rose the other day that he has no chemical weapons. I mean, the man is a liar.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he's got chemical weapons, and we have the evidence for that. But if he will, out of fear of the U.S. strike, pending strike, yield to the idea and yield to Russian pressure, and then American pressure, to allow the UN in a certain period of time to take control of all of the chemical weapons, that's going to be very difficult to do. They're spread out all over the country. And I think David is right that there will have to be some kind of ceasefire. So if you go down this path, you're opening the way to a diplomatic and political solution to the entire mess, if it is possible. And I think the Russian price on this, which we're not focusing on at the moment, but the Russian price on this will be that Assad must remain in power.
Hmm.
That will be the price they will extract.
Yeah. Tom in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. So a few quick comments. First, I support and agree with pretty much everything your guest has to say. I was a little taken back on the idea of credibility, emphasizing how much this would hurt the president's credibility if we did not go through with the idea of them crossing the red line. This credibility would be very short-term at the expense of his and the nation's long-term credibility. I mean, if we, it'll be well understood if we strike, it's going to be largely for our short-term credibility in the world. While I agree that's important to have some credibility internationally, over the intermediate term, much less long-term, it's really going to destroy our credibility and destroy any legacy that President Obama might have. Another comment real quick in regards to the presidential authority, the guidelines to declaring war. We have but one document, and that is the Constitution. And when they're inaugurated, they take an oath to support and defend it. So there should be no other question that comes into play as far as the presidential authority to declare war. It is the Congress, and that's it.
Thank you, Tom, for the call. Marvin.
Well, Tom's making two very good points, and I'll try to answer them quickly. On credibility, the president speaks for the country, not just for himself. And granted, yes, his personal political credibility is on the line, but because he is the president of the United States, he speaks for us all in the world bodies and in world public opinion. My own belief is that his personal credibility would be very badly tarnished, and the national credibility would be badly tarnished. Tom makes the point that maybe that would only be short-term and not medium and long-term. Yes, of course, and all things change with time, but images change as well. The United States had a certain image in the Middle East before the invasion of Iraq in 2003. We have an entirely different image now. You take a look at some of the polling data from 2001, 2002, and early 2003, and now, and you find that the image of the United States has been hugely damaged by the war in Iraq. So these things are immediate, but they have long legs, and they go on for a while. With respect to the Constitution, your second point, I'm totally in agreement, and that's one of the major reasons that I wrote The Road to War, that you have to respect the Constitution, and in it, it is clear that Congress has the right, the duty, the responsibility to declare war. And it is not for the president to do it on his own. But since World War II, presidents have done it on their own, and the Congress has gone along for the ride. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're at a point now, because it is so important, maybe Congress will get serious about implementing its own responsibilities with respect to declaring war.
And isn't it interesting that the president is a constitutional lawyer and in 2008, yes, when he was running for president, said just what you just said, right? About what the Constitution said about going to war.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's something what you just said is terrific. He just said, when presidents say something, I mean, that's why the title of the book, Presidential Commitments, Honored and Betrayed. When presidents say something, given the world in which we live today, where there are so many microphones and cameras and internet picking up everything that anybody says, especially a president, when a president says he will not, there's a red line and you cannot cross the red line in the use of chemical, that becomes a commitment of the United States of America. It's not just the president. It becomes a national commitment. And some of those commitments, and many, in fact, are honored, but several very important ones were betrayed. And when they're betrayed, there is a price that you pay. This president made statements, many of them, that he would never allow Iran to have nuclear weapons. Okay. Does that mean that when, let us say at the end of this year, maybe next year, that's what the scientists claim, Iran is on the edge of having a nuclear weapon? Will the president take action against Iran, or will the president decide that he must once again go to Congress and ask for permission? If it is the latter, the Israelis, who believe that they have a commitment from the president to act, are going to say, wait a minute, we had a commitment. You're betraying that commitment. We're going to do it on our own. And if the Israelis move on their own, they can't move on their own. In fact, because everybody in the Middle East believes, right or wrong, that if Israel acts, the United States is there also. So, you know, what I'm trying to get at here is the complexity of these presidential commitments, what they mean and how they're looked upon by countries the world over.
Yeah. Marvin Kelb, our guest this hour, his book is The Road to War, Presidential Commitments Honored and Betrayed. Our phone number, thanks, Tom, for your call, 800-486-8655. Our lines have been pretty busy, so if you want to leave an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org or go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Marvin Kelb. Daniel is our next caller. Hi.
Hello. Ronald Reagan, especially by conservative Republicans, is credited with the fall of the Soviet Union. Was Gorbachev, glasnost, and perestroika, rather than Reagan, responsible for the collapse and breakup of the Soviet Union? Why did the Soviet Union fall?
Thank you for that question, Daniel. I would say that the central reason for the collapse of communism in the old Soviet Union was the rot within the system itself, economically, politically. The Soviet Union was in a state of collapse. It was sort of, you didn't see it on the outside because the structure of the state was still there. But it was like a log that is hollow, that is rotten from within, and that if you put your foot on it, your foot goes right through it. And that was the Soviet Union. And when Gorbachev then came in and began to talk about perestroika, in other words, the restructuring of communism, what he learned, but it took him a long time to learn it, Daniel, by the way, what he learned was that you cannot simply by proclamation that you are going to reform a rotten system watch it reform itself. It didn't. It just got more and more rotten, more and more corrupt. The corruption exists to this day. The rot is there in many parts of Russia. There have been tremendous changes in Russia in the last 20 years, but there is also a heaviness about the system and an inability to adjust to some of the most fundamental requirements of human decency. Let the Russian people take a deep breath. It's about time.
Thanks, Daniel. Jeff in Madison, hi.
Yes, hello. Complexity is the word. Mr. Kalb, I have truly admired your analytical talents for a long time, yet I wanted to call in because I had to take issue with your characterization previously with another caller of not responding as, quote, an innocent belief in isolationism, end quote. I think one of the most dangerous and innocent beliefs we seem to have as Americans is the belief in our own power to change dynamics in ways that we want or think we want them to go or think they should go. And recently I met with some humanitarian colleagues of mine who are working on the refugee response in Jordan, who said to me, number one, arming the rebels would be, their term was, moronic. And number two, they said the belief that toppling Assad will somehow result in some sort of end game in this war is wrong. It doesn't end things. It just, what it does, it stirs the pot up even more. And so now what we're all doing is looking for a way to help the president, whom I support in most things, or to help him out of the corner that he has painted himself into, highlighted with red lines. It's a leadership style I call TBS, which is to be seen to be doing something. Mm. Sometimes doing something is not called for, and it's not necessarily right. An innocent belief. I'll take my
Thank
comments
you,
up here.
Thank Thanks you. For the call.
Well, it's very, very informed comment, mm-hmm. and I think it's terrific. I don't know quite how to address what Jeff is getting at. If I suggested to him a definition of isolationism that he found offensive, I apologize. I didn't certainly mean that. What I am trying to say here is that the American people have always, for many, many decades now, had a streak of isolationism running through their foreign policy makeup. You can even say, if you wish, you can go back to George Washington and Washington saying, let's not get entangled in European events. That was his way of saying that our fundamental responsibility has to be America. Now, Obama speaks about nation building at home as his principal obligation. He speaks about that very often. And yet he finds himself on the edge of a military conflict in Syria. He doesn't want to be there, but there is a strain in America that has isolationism attached to idealism. And there is the idealistic side of American foreign policy that I think the president is expressing right now, a belief that it is America's responsibility because there's nobody else in the world who will do it. America's responsibility to help people who are in desperate need, and the people in Syria certainly are in that state.
Thank you, Jeff, very much for your call. We go to Jerry in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi. I don't know how to phase this into a question, but it just seems that the government has been killing its people with bombs and bullets for 2 years now. Now they decided to use chemical weapons. For 2 years, we did nothing. Now we find that what we're saying is, oh, it's okay if you kill your people with bombs and bullets, but if you're going to use chemical weapons, no, that's not okay. The whole thing just seems crazy. We've been over there since the first George Bush in 1990 or 91. And we've come away with nothing but losing our men and women over there, and those people still, they're just going after each other, and that whole area is just a mess. And getting involved in any way is not going to change anything.
Marvin Kalb.
Well, that's a very good point. And, Jerry, I have heard that said by experts who have spent much of their lives trying to figure out what goes on in the Middle East and in Syria in particular. And they are of the view that most of them are, not everyone, most of them are of the view that no matter what we do, at the end of the day, it's still going to be a mess and still going to be a mess that only the Syrians themselves can somehow clean up. I suspect that what drives the president now is the feeling that since the United States is the only country in the world that's going to do anything anyway, he is trying to figure out a way that advances America's interests at the same time helps the Syrian people, and he thinks he has found that way. You are skeptical of that, and I must say I join you in that skepticism. However, I am going to be among those Americans who will support the president in what he is doing right now, not because I think it is necessarily the right thing to do, but because I feel to do nothing is at this point worse than doing something.
You mentioned earlier that the quality of advice that presidents were getting was very important. How would you assess the quality of advice that this president is receiving when it comes to Syria and policies in the Middle East, Marvin?
Well, that's a terrific question. We've been talking about that at lunch today, in fact. And I can tell you what people are saying here. What people are saying is that Obama has probably the worst set of foreign policy advisors that any president has had in recent time. I personally believe that is much too strong. I think that Hagel at Defense and Kerry at State are first-rate people. It could be that the president's immediate staff at the White House needs significant improvement. They are the first people a president sees when he gets up in the morning. That's why they are so critically important. And here, I think I do join those who have criticized the president's White House staff as being too narrow and too inexperienced to provide this president of the United States with the advice he needs.
Mm, interesting. Well, your pick, either Korea or Vietnam, full hour sometime down the road. I'd love to talk to you about that.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
Thank you, Marvin. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Marvin Kalb, the book is The Road to War, Presidential Commitments Honored and Betrayed, which has just been released and is incredibly timely. Because of all that's going on in Syria, a number of the interviews with him have centered on that, but it also covers in great detail and with a lot of information that either has been forgotten or hasn't been reported on in such detail, the Korean War and also the Vietnam War through the many administrations that kept us involved in Vietnam. He is the Edward R. Murrow Professor Emeritus at Harvard, guest scholar in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, and had a 30-year career with CBS and NBC News. He was the last hired of the Edward R. Murrow boys, some of the best in journalism. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program, and thanks for all of your calls. A reminder, tonight at 8 o'clock, the president will be speaking to the nation on Syria, whatever form that address may take. And tomorrow at 1, Julian Zelizer from Princeton will be analyzing that, and we'll invite your calls as well.